Hi, and welcome back to Radio New Bloom. I'm your host, Garrett D. In this episode, we will be discussing the proposal in May of a new set of national security laws in Hong Kong, which would introduce criminal offenses for acts such as secession, subversion, foreign interference, and terrorism. Though Hong Kong is no stranger to security laws under the current government, many see this as an attempt by the Chinese government to directly take control of the situation in Hong Kong by bypassing the local legal system. Hong Kong has been in a state of resistance for over a year over the local government's complicity in the degradations of the rights and freedoms which were promised to Hong Kong under the condition of one country, two systems. The proposal of the new national security law certainly adds flame to the fire of what was already a very precarious situation. Many believe that, in many ways, this could spell the end of even giving lip service to one country, two systems, and certainly makes it much more difficult to chart a path forward for the ongoing protest movements, though some believe not all hope is lost on that front. This is also an event with quite significant international impact, and we have seen a variety of responses to this from both the international left as well as certain right-wing and centrist governments. Our guest today on the show to talk about all this is Vince Wong. Vince is a lawyer and research associate at the International Human Rights Program at the University of Toronto Law. He is also a member of Lao San, a decolonial left media outlet in Hong Kong, and a founding member of the Progressive International alongside New Bloom and others. He gives a clear legal analysis in our conversation, both of how this set of laws would differ from the previous system, as well as what options are available for those who oppose it. This episode runs a bit longer than some of our previous ones, but there is a lot of ground we cover here talking about some timely topics, and I really enjoyed hearing Vince share his thoughts on the situation and what it means for Hong Kong going forward. Hope you all enjoy the show. I'm on today with Vince Wong. Vince, would you go ahead and please introduce yourself for the listeners who may not be familiar with you?
Sure. Thanks, Garrett. My name is Vince Wong. I'm a lawyer and research associate at the International Human Rights Program at the University of Toronto's Law School. And I'm also a member of the Lao San Collective, which is a group of decolonial leftist writers, translators, artists, and organizers from Hong Kong and its diaspora. So thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Yeah. So thanks for coming on the show, Vince. Specifically, I wanted to talk today about an article that you had written for Lao San and some of the events around it. We wanted to kind of go over the national security law that was recently proposed for Hong Kong. To start us out with this conversation, can you walk us through the events that led to the proposal of the national security law for Hong Kong in May?
Sure. So it's important to note that the controversy over national security laws is no stranger to Hong Kong politics. So specifically, there's a really controversial article in the mini constitution of Hong Kong known as the Basic Law, Article 23, which basically says the Hong Kong government shall enact laws, so needs to enact laws to prohibit a certain set of national security offenses. So those are treason, secession, sedition, subversion, theft of state secrets, as well as some laws prohibiting ties with foreign political organizations. In 2002 and 2003, the Hong Kong government under the chief executive, Tung Chee Hwa, had basically proposed this bill. And it drew massive public reprimand. So there were concerns around vagueness, risk of arbitrary use by authorities, a massive kind of chilling effect on conduct, speech, and the press. And people were very concerned about not only any kind of activity that could be considered against the interest of the Hong Kong government, because that's like a, you know, it was a very common pastime to criticize the Hong Kong government, but also particularly the Beijing government. They were very scared that the laws written would basically chill all kind of speech and conduct that is against the interests of the People's Republic of China. So these kind of concerns around freedom of press, expression, opinion, assembly, it eventually culminated in a massive demonstration on July 1st, 2003. 500,000 people took to the street. And for the Tung Chee Hwa administration, it was a huge humiliation, and it led to some major politicians quitting, and the government having to withdraw the bill and kind of run back with its tail between its legs. And since then, the national security law has not really been brought up seriously, although it's been brought up at various points by pro-Beijing camps, because it's expected to have massive popular political pushback from the Hong Kong people. So this all changed, and people were, I think, caught unaware, even kind of insiders, on May 21st, a couple of weeks ago, where I would say the way to frame it is that Beijing eventually lost its patience with the Hong Kong government and its people and decided to press this very kind of, you could say, nuclear button by ramming through these national security laws. And not just the laws, the substance of the laws are at issue here, but now Beijing is saying it's going to be drafted by the National People's Congress Standing Committee, so not the Hong Kong government and not passed by LegCo, and applied directly to Hong Kong by fiat. So this clearly violates the spirit and quite possibly the letter of the basic law and one country, two systems. And this decision was approved on May 28th by the National People's Congress plenary session, so the bigger sitting, and it's expected to be fast-laned through the lawmaking process. And so the reaction thus far from Hong Kong observers and politicians is that this is probably the worst case scenario that could happen, because Hong Kong's entire political system is now being undermined and it's reignited protests. There are massive losses to the stock market. People are looking to emigrate in mass, and it's resulting in a lot of condemnation and sanctions from foreign governments.
That's interesting that you brought up what happened in 2003, because that context makes it sound a lot like this is not the first time that Hong Kong has been through this. So it's interesting for us to know that this is actually something that's been on people's mind for a while now, and kind of getting into the letter of this law and what the concerns are surrounding this. What exactly does this national security law call for?
Sure. So the actual law is being, the actual law that will be the final version is actually being drafted right now. But the decision of the National People's Congress contains certain like core elements. One is that the law will contain offenses criminalizing conduct that quote unquote seriously endangers national security. And the actual offenses that have been put out there are separatism, right, or secession, subversion. So, things that are essentially subvert the ability of the Hong Kong government to do its duty, as well as the PRC government, and terrorism, and activities of foreign and overseas forces. So it's still kind of broad, like the broad categories we know, but the actual term of how the actual wording of it is not spelled out yet. Two other things that the decision also includes is that it instructs the Hong Kong government to pass its own national security legislation under Article 23 as well. So there will be basically this Beijing-written law that will apply, and then they expect the Hong Kong government to pass another set of laws to supplement those national security laws. And then the final thing, which is very, very worrying from a Hong Kong perspective, is that the decision states the Central People's Government will create organs and institutions in Hong Kong for the protection of national security, and to lawfully perform duties related to the preservation of national security. So people are really trying to figure out what that means. But essentially, Beijing is opening the pathway to create an actual national security bureau or some sort of apparatus within Hong Kong that will somehow have the responsibility for enforcing the protection of these national security laws, which is, again, something that has never happened and is really deleterious to one country, two systems.
I want to get back to those national security agencies and talk a little bit more about how that's going to affect life in Hong Kong. But kind of going to the basic law that you just brought up, which is you described as Hong Kong's mini constitution. So now going over some of the provisions that this new national security law is calling for, what is this difference between what's being called for now and what's currently in place under the basic law? I know that there's a couple of articles that are in play here. And how would you describe the changes that are going to be made to the situation now?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And we're digging into the legality now, but I think it's important for people to know. One thing that should be noted is that Hong Kong's criminal laws already include a couple of the offenses under Article 23, specifically treason, sedition, and official secrets, or rather the protection of official secrets. So these criminal laws are already on the books. This is probably why Beijing did not specifically mention them in their decision of the National People's Congress. That's why those laws are going to be, you could say, they didn't exist before. And then so Beijing is going to try to pass them by fiat. And this is different from, so that's the substantive law. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the process of lawmaking. It's different from the process of lawmaking under the basic law, because Article 23 of the basic law tells the Hong Kong government that they should pass their own specific set of laws, says nothing about the timeline. And because of this Hong Kong people's massive popular pushback, they've succeeded in frustrating the government and LegCo time and time again from actually passing the slate of security laws, national security laws that they want. And so this is really different from the current system of lawmaking, in that Beijing is saying, forget it, we're gonna forget the whole thing. We're not gonna deal with these pandems in LegCo anymore, trying to filibuster or water down our laws. We don't care about what, you could have 100 and another million people go to the streets. We are going to pass it. We're going to have no more kind of procedural resistance, and that will be that. So that's really how it's different from the current system under the basic law.
So I want to talk about how they're able to do this. So we're talking kind of about two main bodies here, the National People's Congress in Beijing, as well as the Hong Kong Legislative Council. Talking about what's provisioned in Article 23 and some of the laws that Hong Kong is allowed to make for themselves, what legal methods is Beijing using to promulgate this law directly into Hong Kong? How is this working under what's provided in the basic law already? Is there a certain way that they can pass this by fiat legally?
Yes. So the loophole here is the National People's Congress Standing Committee usually cannot pass laws directly for Hong Kong. And the only exception in the basic law is essentially found in Article 18. Article 18 allows the People's Republic of China to directly apply laws in Hong Kong through an annex to the basic law, which is called Annex 3. It's a list of certain laws that Beijing is applying directly to Hong Kong. And it's written in a way that is very limited. So it only allows certain People's Republic of China laws to qualify, specifically three areas. This is laws relating to defense, foreign affairs, or quote unquote, other matters outside the limits of the autonomy of Hong Kong. So this was essentially a way to codify the one country, two systems. There's a couple of things that when it comes to military stuff, when it comes to foreign affairs that requires national sovereignty, we're going to take care of that. Beijing is going to take care of it. Everything else essentially is under Hong Kong autonomy. And we know that anti-terrorism laws, laws such as secession, subversion, treason, sedition, are normally thought of as in kind of comparative jurisprudence as public order laws. So they're not laws typically related to defense or foreign affairs, And we know that these slate of national security laws are within the limits of the autonomy of Hong Kong, because otherwise why would Article 23 specifically mention that Hong Kong is supposed to pass these laws, right? So we know that these national security laws are within the autonomy of Hong Kong. So the basically, this is constitutionally like a little bit fraught, right? But the National People's Standing Committee still needs a legal excuse to directly pass these laws. And for sure, they're going to use Article 18. And they're going to try to finagle their way to saying that these national security laws relate to one of the three exceptions in Article 18. And once they decide, then they can immediately attach it to Annex 3, and then it becomes Hong Kong law. And then you kind of dare the Hong Kong people and the courts to challenge it, right?
Right. So I want to talk about this challenge too. So you mentioned just now once they decide. And so you wrote in your article recently with Lao Sun that there is a legal challenge that could be made that this is outside the purview of Article 18, meaning this national security law. It doesn't apply to some of the provisions that are made for Beijing to directly pass laws in Hong Kong. So talking about such a challenge, you mentioned just now that it could go through some of the court systems. What do you mean that there is a case to be made, and what are the political implications around this?
Sure. I'll make the legal analysis first. And I began talking about it a little bit in the previous question, but the legal question is whether this slate of security laws can be satisfyingly categorized into any of the three areas of defense, foreign affairs, or outside of Hong Kong's autonomy. And because they usually fall under public order laws, a different group of laws, it's going to be very difficult, honestly, for Beijing, but more likely the government of Hong Kong lawyers, to make this argument in court and have it stand. So the argument that it's unconstitutional or ultra vires, like beyond the power that the Constitution gives you, is quite strong. Two questions come up. So let's say a real good barrister makes these arguments, and they look pretty good on paper. One, is the judge really going to feel comfortable and empowered and properly independent and impartial to say to Beijing, yeah, like what the laws that you created are unconstitutional and I'm going to strike them down, like as an individual? That's, you know, of course we have the nominal notion of judicial independence, but that's going to be very, very, that
it's
person
politically fraught, definitely.
Put that person in the witness protection program, right?
Right.
It's definitely politically fraught. And so let's say it eventually moves up the courts and they do consider at least part of it ultra vires and unconstitutional. Here's the kicker. Beijing, the National People's Congress Standing Committee, under Article 158 of the Basic Law, holds the final power to interpret the law as they wish. So they hold essentially the power of the final constitutional court, and they can interpret it however the hell they want. And given that they are also the body that wrote the law and have every single political interest to say that it's constitutional, they hold all the cards, and there's no reason to think that they won't overrule the court's decision if it goes to the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong. So that's what I mean by, although it's a paradox in that a legal challenge to the constitutionality would be very, very, very strong, but because of the way that the basic law is structured, all of these kind of constitutional guarantees are downgraded to basically the whims of the National People's Standing Congress's Standing Committee. If Beijing wants to press the nuclear option and interpret it in a way that is kind of formally unconstitutional, they can do that if they think it's politically expedient.
Yeah, there. I think that from what you said just now, that analysis, there seems to be a sense of the inevitability of this thing passing, even if there is an argument to be made in the courts about the legality of it, that the final say does lie still with the National People's Congress. And then you get into a situation now where what do you do politically about this? And it kind of puts the ball back in the people of Hong Kong's court in a way, if China does decide to use, as you just said, now this nuclear option. The Hong Kong people have been engaged in protest since last year with the proposition of a law which would have allowed for those charged with a crime to be extradited to face the legal system in mainland China. So these protests have been ongoing, as we've seen, even through the coronavirus crisis. And some polls have shown locally that there's popular support for these movements amongst the majority of Hong Kongers. What potential impact would using this option to directly promulgate this law in Hong Kong have on these protest movements?
Yeah, so I think the big difference here is before the Hong Kong people were essentially protesting against their own government and their own, you know, bodies of that government, including specifically the Hong Kong police force, with the understanding that Beijing was holding all the cards from behind the scenes. But there were always, you could always protest your own government and something would happen, right? It was more like the National People's Congress and the Xi administration. They are influencing things from behind the scenes, but they will never completely break off the mask and say this is not like one country, two systems anymore, right? The difference now is that if Beijing is able to pass laws directly through this legal portal of Article 18, who do you even protest against? Right? You're not protesting the Lam administration anymore. I mean, you could, but they're just a puppet government. And the same thing with you know, elements that you might find unattractive in the Legislative Council. You are actually now protesting directly against the CCP. And this is a complete change, and the risks are entirely different. So with the passing of these laws, I think that one, protesting en masse is going to be met with harsher consequences. But probably the more important one is that individual actions of political resistance will be much, much more dangerous. So this is kind of one of the reasons you see Hong Kongers flocking to install VPNs to protect their identity online, because this national security apparatus, I think the heavy lifting that it's going to do is to essentially pick off people one by one outside of an actual protest setting. So it's going to have a massive chilling effect on everyone. And I think you already have kind of unlawful assembly, riots, the emergency regulations ordinance to deal with, to give all the legal cover you need to crack down pretty hard on protests. What this is going to, these sets of laws are going to do is essentially use digital posts, group chats, facial recognition on video cameras as evidence to arrest and charge people with, you know, secession, subversion, sedition, terrorism, and pick people off one by one. And that was also a massive concern for journalists and publishers, because they may not know where they cross the line in terms of platforming somebody who has a secessionist agenda or say something that is subversive to the political order. That gray area, it's going to be a massive cost and massive risk for journalists. And it's going to be another massive blow for an already reeling Hong Kong press. So that's where I really see it happening, that it's going to do most of its work in individual actions, really putting intra-psychic pressure on people to think twice about whether they actually say anything that could be construed against the Beijing authorities.
Absolutely. I want to hone in a little bit on something you said about the risks really increasing and who the protesters are protesting against. Up until this point, we've seen a lot of anti-protest movement done and carried out by the Hong Kong police. I know that the Hong Kong police force itself has been a major object of protest during this whole situation. You talked a little bit earlier about the possibility of direct law enforcement by Chinese national security agencies. If this law were to pass, do you think that it could shift over from the responsibility of the Hong Kong police force to Chinese national security agencies being directly involved in suppressing the protest movements in Hong Kong? And what do you think that the implications of this would be?
I think this part of the decision of the National People's Congress was quite shocking. I know it was shocking to me. And it pretty much enables and is directly, they're directly saying that they're going to create some sort of national security bureau inside of Hong Kong to deal with these national security laws. And my guess is that if they came out and actually said that and wrote that down, then it really wouldn't be established, you know, could just twiddle their thumbs and, you know, kind of make a couple of statements or maybe help with some sort of intelligence from the Hong Kong police. They would probably take on pretty quick a law enforcement intelligence function, which has rightfully kind of sent people into a panic. And the calculus of that changes, you know, quite a bit again, because you're having governments and LegCo bypassed in this particular case. Now you are having the organ that is doing law enforcement also starting to be bypassed as well. And then so it changes. So, I mean, this is just so vague and it's so speculative at this time. But even if you were to try to protest the Hong Kong police force, I mean, that's been difficult enough. They you know, one of the five major demands is that there is actual police accountability and an independent kind of commission of inquiry to oversee the police. Now, you're not even going to get that. You're going to have a direct kind of Beijing national security bureau that may have its own law enforcement power. Well, how do you even advocate for accountability and oversight for that kind of body, right? It seems so kind of absurd that I don't even know if Hong Kong people would even try to crystallize that into a demand. So that kind of like immediately changes the calculus, and it remains to be seen exactly how this National Security Bureau will be formed, you know, what kind of function it will have and how it will work with the Hong Kong police. But it changes the game significantly.
Absolutely. I think another thing that you touched on earlier that really changes the situation as it was before is the introduction of these new provisions to combat certain actions, including secession, subversion, foreign interference, and terrorism, which is what the letter of the law says. So the introduction of this word terrorism is what I want to talk about. There's a lot of things that can be put under this umbrella once this word is used. Opposition to the protest movements have frequently used this word and described these protest actions as acts of terrorism. So it's obviously a very loaded word politically. It's a word that's been used a lot by the United States in context of the war on terror to justify actions such as government surveillance for military intervention. Most recently, we also saw the Trump administration use the term terrorism to reference anti-fascist or Antifa groups in the United States because of the ongoing Black Lives Matter and George Floyd death protest. Mm-hmm. What are your opinions on the use of this term in Hong Kong? And how do you think that this term specifically will be associated with what's going on with the national security law?
Sure. I'll make a quick comment about Hong Kong, but I think the key to thinking about the terrorist designation and offense requires us to broaden our analysis to connect the dots outside of Hong Kong. So in Hong Kong, I imagine that the terrorism offense will probably be used to charge some conduct that was previously designated, you know, that would be under rioting, you know, that probably rioting attracts a max 10-year prison term. And surely terrorism will attract some much longer kind of prison term, if not life. And so I imagine some of that conduct will now be kind of using terrorism to upgrade the charges. And it's also the first step in formalizing that kind of anti-terrorism discourse that we were hearing out of Beijing with respect to the Hong Kong movement in law and policy. And it certainly won't be the last that you'll see kind of anti-terrorism being used as justification for law and policy in Hong Kong. And as you said, I think it will be used over time to justify greater surveillance, greater militarization of the police. That is going to be, that's a thing kind of you see everywhere where the terrorism is used as a massive kind of justification to put down and a harsher crackdowns, right? As you said, the legal term of terrorism is so loaded, and actually the criminal charge of terrorism, it usually doesn't apply to that many cases, right? But it's really the political and signaling symbolism kind of heft of it that is the big difference. And maybe if I could broaden the analysis a little bit, it really shows us how September 11th really changed the world, and we're still kind of dealing with its fallout, in that the global war of terror created zones through terrorism of legal and political exception, that basically countries can do whatever the heck they want, right? And there's a professor at Columbia University, Bernard Harcourt, who wrote this incredible book, Counterinsurgency, How the U.S. Government Went to War Against Its Own People. And it really talked about how the lessons and the tactics used by U.S. counterterrorism military in Iraq and in Afghanistan is now being used as a mode of governance to bring back home, a mode of governance, counterinsurgency. And China has really, 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 really embraced it. Ever since 2014 in Tibet, and especially in 2016 in Xinjiang, counterinsurgency as a method of governance is now the default gold standard in dealing with any borderlands that a nation or place where there is significant kind of like unrest. And you see this now everywhere from right-wing governments around the world. For example, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi uses it in almost exactly the same way in Kashmir. So it's really, it signals kind of this global, including in the U.S., this global kind of shift towards terrorism and counterinsurgency as a mode of governance in a place where normally it would be those people are just protesters, right? Or they may have kind of legitimate legal grievances, but they, you know, they may, it may kind of like escalate into a riot. And the question is whether, you know, like to put down that riot. And that's kind of that had been the dominant conception beforehand. But when you introduce terrorism into it, now you can justify all sorts of legal and political exceptions that will really ultimately turn the place into a police state.
Let's connect the dots a little bit more on this as well and broaden this analysis, because I want to talk about some of the points you just brought up, particularly about the way that the militarization of the police is used by right-wing governments to suppress activities that would in many cases just be deemed as normal protest activities falling under the legal rights of the citizens there. Particularly, I want to talk about what's going on right now in the United States. So as of the time of this recording, we are seeing popular protest movements in almost every major city in the United States stemming from the police killing of George Floyd. So some of these similarities have come up in both social media and in the traditional news media about what's going on in Hong Kong and what's going on with the United States right now. And some of the members of the U.S. government, even those who have voiced support for Hong Kong in the past and for the protest movements, are pretty vocal about the use of military intervention to put down some of these protest movements. Now, some of these comparisons have drawn some criticism online, given the different circumstances between the two countries. But I wanted to ask your opinion on it, since so much has changed from the time you wrote that article. talking about the way that the protest movements in the U.S. are unfolding right now versus what we've seen in Hong Kong. Do you believe that some of these comparisons are apt?
Sure. I'd just like to maybe say a few words up front about that drawing direct comparisons between two political contexts is just naturally fraught with danger. But realistically, that never stops people from doing it because that's just how folks work, right? Like that's just how their minds work. And so the best approach, I think, is perhaps, you know, not to ever expect people to, kind of condemn them every single time they try to draw connections, but that rather comparisons between political contexts should be done respectfully and with humility, you know, kind of making pains to reach out to folks that are most directly affected and have conversations specifically without any sort of conflation or kind of a value signaling. And so, I mean, it gets very messy and it's really gotten messy with the Hong Kong and kind of Black Lives Matter protests. I guess what I will say is that the Black Lives Matter protests, the George Floyd killing being kind of the instigator of it in 2020, are about police violence and brutality, yes, but also specifically about anti-Black racism, which has a long and tortured 400-plus-year legacy that has shaped the very foundation of the United States as a country, and even before that. So that the number of people who have been kind of brutalized and enslaved and then killed by racialized police violence and the damage of the prison industrial complex on Black communities over generations is just sort of unfathomable. And there are also kind of enormous racialized socioeconomic grievances behind that, right? So, estimated by New York Times that for every $100 in white family net wealth, Blacks hold $5. Of net family wealth. So, you know, that being said, again, that goes to kind of say you can't really properly compare these contexts, and you shouldn't. But there are common causes that people can think about in terms of whether one can stand in solidarity or one should stand in solidarity with both, and which I argue, and I think Lao San argues, that you can't, right? If you kind of stand for opposing police violence and impunity for police violence, well, you can probably support both. If you stand for greater kind of democratic accountability and governance and sort of divesting away from police as a catch-all way to deal with social and health and community problems, then you probably will want to support both. If you stand up for freedom of expression, assembly, freedom of the press, probably want to support both. Same with freeing political prisoners. And especially, Hong Kong has kind of come out pretty quickly in a couple of months from when the protest started to having Gai San Geng Dui disband the police as one of the major demands. And you can hear those sign of same demands happening and becoming more mainstream in the U.S. protests of defund the police. That has actually been more popular than the typical kind of liberal reform of better diversity training or better use of force training or body cameras or, you know, what have you. So you can certainly make those, I think, common cause connections without doing that conflation. That being said, I will kind of draw something for perhaps Hong Kongers to think about is that on May 7th, there was a South Asian man who was killed on Nathan Road, which is, probably the most popular road in Kowloon, by Hong Kong police, putting a knee to the neck and back of this gentleman for several minutes in a very violent manner. And that person eventually succumbed to his injuries and died in a kind of very similar method to the George Floyd death. And that might be, so Black Lives Matter might be an opportunity, I think, to think about anti-racism in the context of Hong Kong, to think about racialized police violence in Hong Kong. What does it mean that the police force used lethal force against this South Asian man who was then immediately kind of slandered by the police as, you know, intoxicated or on drugs, even though a drug test later came back negative, right? What does it mean that there was like no attempt to really de-escalate? Like armed cops should not be how we deal with folks with substance abuse issues, right? So I think Black Lives Matter can actually, rather than just focusing on the question of whether Hong Kong people should support it, it might be even more helpful to think about the reflections that Black Lives Matter has for Hong Kong in terms of anti-racism and particular kind of anti-Black, anti-Brown racism. And that, I think, would be a very kind of powerful political solidarity that happens in Hong Kong in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. So I think that might be something that is very meaningful, that kind of gets away from this kind of use of the U.S. right wing in supporting and lifting up the Hong Kong protests in kind of lockstep with their anti-China kind of foreign policy, and then essentially crushing, killing protesters and sicking a militarized police on Black Lives Matter protesters at home. I mean, that is kind of the pinnacle of hypocrisy. So I think people are really starting to see that and are starting to grapple with what that means.
Absolutely. And I want to talk a little bit about how people can display international solidarity with what's going on in Hong Kong while avoiding some of that hypocrisy as well, specifically in the context of the national security law, as we're seeing protests erupt all over the world, how those maybe with a mind towards anti-fascism or police brutality or any other form of oppression can stand in solidarity with the movement without falling into the traps of having the same cause at home not be supported as well. So talking about the international response to the promulgation of this law, we've seen it vary quite significantly from country to country. So in the United States, like you said, we've seen some right-wing politicians who normally would use Hong Kong sort of as a pawn against for their sort of anti-China, anti-communist sort of agendas, praise Hong Kong while at the same time in the United States suppressing some of these popular movements as well. Similarly, we've seen the right-wing government in the United Kingdom sort of bandy about the idea of granting some Hong Kongers the ability to emigrate from Hong Kong into the United Kingdom. How do you think that the international response to what's going on in Hong Kong has played out during this climate, both legally and geopolitically? Is there anything problematic you see in the response to what's going on there, particularly for some of these right-wing governments?
Sure. And essentially, this is like the raison d'etre, like this is the reason why kind of Lausanne was formed, right? To try to have an accounting for both China's kind of imperialism as well as the US-led kind of Western bloc imperialism. And it's a very kind of tricky position because in some ways it goes away from the mainstream Hong Kong efforts of kind of global diplomacy by appealing to Western states. And so some of the responses that we've seen from this really kind of disastrous national security law scenario has been in the US, for example. It's instigated the Hong Kong Human Rights Democracy Act, and the State Department has said that it's going to take away its status, the special status of Hong Kong in sort of trade and visas. And this was supposed to be the leverage, right? The poison pill that Beijing would never swallow in terms of its kind of exertion of greater control over Hong Kong. It was supposed to be kind of that leverage that deterred away from the breaking of one country, two systems. Well, now they've broken it, and now what, right? So, I mean, you take away the special status, but that hurts Hong Kong's economy more than it will ever hurt China's economy. So that has kind of turned into this Lam Tao, like if I burn, you burn kind of mentality for Hong Kong. One of the things that has been, I would say, a positive, but a qualified positive in the international response is what you were referring to with the UK government is kind of greater mobility rights as a specific demand from Hong Kong people to essentially facilitate mass emigration from Hong Kong, given its severe kind of deterioration in civil, economic, and political rights. And this is a very significant change, right? Some countries are starting to consider kind of easier visas applications. Canada's taking a look at that. The UK is a big one in terms of, it's probably the biggest one because of the BNO. Boris Johnson's administration is considering offering a path to citizenship, although that is now kind of playing unhappily with his very kind of xenophobic right-wing base. And so, you know, kind of greater mobility rights is an interesting new thing. It's a significant thing. And that might be really good for the people that have the privileges and ability to leave. But what about those who, you know, don't have that ability to leave, right? That don't have those privileges or don't want to leave because of love of their home? These mobility privileges are essentially very, very, very heavily divided by class, because the immigration systems of Western countries have almost all in lockstep become extremely economic and nationalist in purpose. So it's generally folks that have money or have a lot of education that would be willing to, able to satisfy those clauses. So it creates a lot of difficulty, I think, and it creates this sort of max exodus that leaves the most kind of vulnerable people in lines fire. And then so what do you do about that? And that's sort of the, we're trying to think through what kind of future potentialities and what sort of emancipatory political possibilities are possible outside of just relying on Western sort of reactions to deal with mass emigration.
I appreciate you talking about what a tricky position it is for the Hong Kong protest movements and for the decolonial left in Hong Kong, because I think that in a similar situation, New Bloom has seen with Taiwan that it can also be tricky to navigate these as well. You don't want to rely too much on governments like the United States that have shown a propensity for right-wing imperialism. But at the same time, you want to preserve that space for a real conversation about how to maintain self-determination. And it can be difficult not to overly rely on allies that can appear repugnant with some of their xenophobic and imperialist actions. So sort of wrapping up the conversation here, talking about the future and what this can look like for the people of Hong Kong, what recourse do you see for Hong Kongers and the Hong Kong protest movements in light of all this, specifically the Hong Kong decolonial left?
Sure. And I think that's what we're, you know, I appreciate the comparison to Taiwan and the difficulties navigating that. Lausanne, I think, has from the beginning been trying to chart a new course that gets us away from the dictates of global capital that have essentially strangled its ability to change or to have a different sort of politics. And so I think there's a couple of things that really matter. And J.S. Tan and I, when we co-wrote that national security law piece, had this at the end, is that the game has really changed. And now the oppressions that were happening on mainland China for folks that were leftists or folks that were progressives or that were unionists or journalists, they are going to more directly affect in similar ways folks trying to do that work in Hong Kong. And so our destinies and our fates are now much, much more tied directly with mainland Chinese dissidents. And what does, how do we build those connections with sort of mainland unions? Well, there's kind of barely any unions because they've been crushed, but mainland labor activists, journalists, feminists, queer groups, anti-racist groups. How do we think about internationalism? This kind of moment that global prison abolition is now the push of so many different places from the US, but then also to the Middle East and North Africa, also to India, also to Latin America. There's a stronger sort of internationalism in connecting with the dozens of kind of mass movements that are happening in the world right now. And really thinking about the political power that we need to liberate Hong Kong from the bottom up. And instead of primarily appealing to Western governments, because I think that road has, we've kind of walked it as far as we could go. What next? And I think Lao San is really trying to chart a course, a decolonial course, an anti-fascist specifically kind of course that I think even folks in the mainland, there will be a lot of people that would support and be in solidarity with that kind of positioning. And that I think is really the political power that we need to actually sort of change things, to fight for the protection and respect of human rights for all, rather than just privileges for some. And that's kind of the project, I think, of Lao San, and that's really why I feel really privileged to be a small part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, speaking from the perspective of New Bloom, it would be great to see some of the future developments between solidarity with people from Taiwan and Hong Kong as well. I think that's a really key ingredient to all of this. And, you know, bears watching the Tsai administration to see what comes of this in the future, particularly as Hong Kong is going through this moment. Well, I thank you for coming on the show today, Vince. It was great talking to you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to walk our listeners through not only the law itself, but some of the implications around it and some of the future strategies that people can use to continue to show solidarity. Before we go, is there anything else that you would like for the listeners to know?
No, not too much. I think if you're interested in reading more from our publication, it's Lao San, LAUSAN.HK. So we're, you can check out our website. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. And yeah, thanks so much to New Bloom. Thanks to you, Garrett, for your time. And this is just such a critical moment, I think, in not only Hong Kong politics and Taiwan politics, but really the world. We're dealing with a kind of a wrecking thing we've never seen before.
Absolutely.
And people try to make sense of it. It's a difficult thing. And you know, we're really happy that there are, you know, kind of like-minded people out there and allies out there. So thanks for facilitating this, and thanks for folks for listening.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's all for today. I'd like to thank our guest today, Vince, for coming on the show to share his thoughts. You can continue to check out work from Vince and other members of Lao San at LAUSAN.HK or on Twitter and Facebook. I'd also like to thank the members of our podcast team, Nick Haggerty, Yuchen Lai, and Brian Hui. Until next time, this is your host, Garrett D., and thank you for listening to Radio New Bloom. Good night, Taiwan.